Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Line of Sight by James Queeley. Narrated by Keith Sellen Wright. Prologue. They always said, don't run. Don't resist. As Kevin Mathis sprinted down South 11th Street, lungs burning from the cold air, and too many, I'll only smoke two each day, cigarettes, he wished they could have seen what he was running from and why it doesn't always matter what you did or didn't do. He chugged along, fists balled up, elbows swinging toward his hips in violent motions. Punch the midget, like the track coach said, that whole week he actually went to practice freshman year. Back then, 14 years old with less mileage on his airways and fewer 2 a.m. drive-through meals padding his stomach, he might have been able to open a lead on his pursuer. But as the footfalls got closer, echoing through the spaces between the apartments and birdcage homes that you couldn't tell apart even when the sun lit up Newark's West Ward, he knew his legs weren't what would keep him alive. Kevin spun left, away from the few working streetlights into the vacant lot of a Family Dollar, hugging the chain-link fence that separated parking spaces from row houses, looking for the hole he'd cut in it however many years ago, the shortcut he still used from time to time. The shouts came in spurts, profanity tucked in between authoritative commands. Cop speak, but he wasn't sure the guy was a cop. The way he'd walked up to his porch, no uniform, way more confident than anyone roaming the neighborhood at 1 a.m. should have been, made him think the guy might have been hiding a gun or a badge. But Kevin had been arrested before, knew the steps to that dance. Besides, with everything that had been going on, the cops that knew where to find him also knew it was best to steer clear, for their own sake. Still, the only people who came to Kevin's door that late at night were fiends or friends. This man was neither, which meant he was trouble, which meant Kevin needed to move. He let his hands run along the fence until a sharp edge bit one of his fingers. The hole was narrow, ragged. They'd done a shit job with the bolt cutters back in high school when he and a few friends had made this little escape route in the first place. Metal scraped his forearm, leaving the kind of chalk-color scratch that won't draw blood, but hurts like hell in the moment. Something stalked off underfoot as he crept through the dead grass and litter. A stray, disturbed from its slumber, rushing through the November cold in search of somewhere else to hide. Maybe they'd both get lucky. Kevin stumbled, hands out in front of him like he was just learning to walk. There was a hole in the fence at the other end of the block, cut on the same day for the same reason, which led out toward Woodland Cemetery. He heard a high-pitched yelp from behind him. His unwanted friend had found the hole, and the fence wasn't interested in letting him through. The metal rattled like a set of keys in a dryer, and the annoyed howls faded as he found the space slashed into the end of the alley. He exploded into the street, adrenaline surging into his legs as he imagined the man and his gun wrestling with his shortcut. Woodland was in sight, the old oak trees with the shaggy branches waving hello in a winter gust. Some people liked to think you'd find more bodies in Woodland with a flashlight than a shovel. The cemetery wasn't the ideal place to run if you wanted to keep breathing, but unless one of the neighbors decided to fling open their doors and offer Kevin a hiding spot with a space heater, it would have to do. The old cemetery, with its ornate mausoleums and half-filled granite crypts, was a little too upscale for the neighborhood residents who usually ended up planning funerals a generation before any mother should have to think like that. Most of the people buried at Woodland had gone to ground in recent years, their lives ending on nearby Springfield Avenue, one of Newark's main drug corridors. Anyone in Woodland at that time of night was at risk of becoming a permanent resident, likely to get carried out in an ambulance, leaving their grieving family to wonder how the hell they're going to afford to bring them back in a hearse. Kevin's mother wouldn't have to stress that. She'd smoked away any responsibility to him, living or dead, before those freshman track practices. Dad, though. He didn't want to think about that. Kevin had to at least make it to his 21st birthday, let his father live out the fantasy of buying that first legal beer, even though they both knew he'd started sneaking them years ago. He ducked behind a stone structure with a tiny angel sitting on top, a naked baby dancing to an unheard song. Kevin never understood why people put those angels anywhere near headstones. They were just dead kids with wings. Kevin hunched over, bending his knees, trying to shake the fire out of his chest. His heart rate fell slightly from jackhammer to bass drum as he tried to figure out who was chasing him and why. He thought about the last time he was in court, his last pickup from Levon and the one before, the officer with the zigzag scar, the video on his cell phone. He leaned back against the stone, breath returning to normal, nothing but darkness between him and where he'd run from. He was safe, until he turned his head the other way, found the shadow peering out from the stone condo full of dead people to the right. An arm came up, a familiar shape where a hand should have been. He didn't run. He didn't resist. It didn't matter. Chapter 1.
And you're sure this'll work?
No. Of course it will, I said, peering through the dirt specks on the windshield of my never-quite-clean Olds Cutlass, scanning the sidewalk outside the Newark Police Department's 3rd Precinct for the guy Officer Scannell was so worried about.
This just seems a little out there,
Scannell said, rapping his fingers incessantly against my dashboard.
What happens if he says no?
Well then, Officer Scannell, you'd be fucked.
He won't say no, I replied, watching someone round the corner leading up to the precinct's limestone steps, pretty sure it wasn't the guy we were looking for. But I couldn't be entirely certain because Scannell's nerve-addled stammer was distracting me and making me wish I'd never quit smoking.
How the hell can you be sure? He asked.
I couldn't.
I am, I said,
tongue far out ahead of my brain, as usual.
God damn it, man, this is my career on the line. My ass, Scannell said, like I didn't already know that. I could use a little explanation.
The whining was driving me nuts. Scannell was a big enough guy, probably went 230, 6 foot plus. I'd heard him speak before, years earlier, when we'd both been in the same room, but he had no reason to notice. He was a natural baritone, the kind of guy who used profanity in place of cleverness to make it seem like he had something to say. Scannell's voice was bred tough until a boot got anywhere near his throat. Then it turned into a mix of helium and worry. A little kid with a bad report card. I gritted my teeth, thought about a smoke, and gritted more. 47 days without a cancer stick. In 47 days, I'd run at least 20 miles, saved nearly $500, and managed to look slightly less than spastic in a pickup basketball game. Scannell wasn't sending me back to zero, but I needed something in place of a nicotine buzz. Berating my client seemed like the next best thing.
"You're not exactly in a position to ask questions," I said.
"I hired you, didn't I?"
he asked.
"Yeah, to keep your ass out of the jackpot. Not to pat your head and tell you everything's going to be fine."
Scannell sat up straight, crowded me a little.
"You know what happens when someone talks to me like that on the job?" he asked.
"If I had to guess, I'd say you'd beat their ass in the middle of a drug bust, tuck about $6,000 in your vest, then turn in a weak-ass case that doesn't even get you past a grand jury, freak out when said suspect goes to pick up his personal property and finds it light, then run to someone who sent you to me for help." His face froze, jaw slack and stupid, and he shrunk back to his side of the car.
"Allegedly," he said.
Allegedly. The useless word I used to type in sentences like, "allegedly shot 6 people, or "allegedly sexually assaulted his stepdaughter." A legal term I had to write to protect monsters because libel lawsuits are like lower back tattoos.
With Scannell cowed, I went back to staring at the sidewalk, hoping to catch sight of Antonio Rice before he got anywhere near the precinct's front door. The third was on Market Street, north of Ferry, close to the city's ironbound section. The neighborhood was all Hispanic and Portuguese, but we'd been here for close to an hour, and I hadn't seen a black man anywhere. Unless I'd missed Rice while debating the facts of life with Scannell, he should have been here by now. I turned to the officer who was staring out the window and plotting his revenge against me. "A thought," I said. "How are you so damn sure Rice will come down here to file a complaint? You can do that over the phone." "The skell doesn't know that," he replied.
"And you're certain that Rice isn't smarter than the average skell?"
"No, I'm certain that I've done a solid for the desk sergeant in the third, and when someone called trying to feed me to the rat squad, he told him they didn't take complaints over the phone. Then he did me the courtesy of giving me enough time to find you."
God bless the blue wall.
On cue, a tall, skinny black man wearing a camouflage jacket rounded the corner at the back of the precinct, hop-stepping with a determined gait and a slight limp. His hair was done up in twists, just like the mugshot I'd seen on the state corrections website.
"That's him," Scannell muttered, sitting straight up.
I waited a few seconds and let Rice get closer to the precinct, watched Scannell freak out a little. A small part of me wanted to stay in the car, let the universe take out its trash. But I needed the money more than the department needed to be rid of an oaf like Scannell, who sure as shit would cost me business when he inevitably bitched about losing his job in every cop bar between here and Montclair. November greeted me with an icy blast as I got out, forcing me to tuck my jacket close as I marched across the street and into Rice's path. "Excuse me," I said, nearly breaking into a jog to catch up to him. He ignored me. "Yo, man," I tried again, earning a half turn of his head, but nothing else. "Yo, Tonio," I shouted, "slow the fuck down." He stopped, turned. Abrasive was Newark's native tongue. Antonio gave me the once-over, trying to figure out if he knew me, if I was cop or criminal, friend or foe. 50 feet from a police precinct, and even then, he didn't feel safe. It was the kind of practiced skepticism that kept predators from turning into prey in Newark's West and South Wards. At least for a little while.
"I don't know you," he said.
"You do not.
But you know my name."
"Sort of. Know why you're here, too," I said. Antonio took a step back, hand traveling toward his waist on instinct. "It's not there, Antonio. We both know you're not going to walk into that precinct and lodge a complaint against a police officer while carrying a concealed weapon," I said. "Besides, I just want to talk."
"Then talk. Start by telling me how the fuck did you know I was going to be here and why I came? Actually, hold up. First off, who the fuck are you?"
"My name is Russell Avery," I replied, "and I think this will go a lot easier for you if you don't walk into that building."
"That a threat?"
I ran a hand through my hair and craned my neck. The hell was everyone always so defensive for?
"No, man, I don't do threats. I'm all about mutual benefit.
See, you going in there doesn't get you any closer to your missing money," I said.
"You not going in there?
Things could go another way."
"And what if this ain't about money, huh?" Antonio asked. "Maybe I just want to see that fat fuck swing for this. Do my civic duty, you know?"
"It's always about money, Antonio, but I'll play along if you want to pretend it's not," I said. "So you walk in there, right? File your complaint. Meet with a detective from the vaunted Internal Affairs Bureau. Then the fat fuck, as you so eloquently put it, comes down here to fight the charges with a union lawyer. Then there's an administrative hearing. You know how often that ends with the cop getting in trouble? Carry the one round down to zero, and it's right around never. That's no spin, by the way, that's math. This department got something like 200 of these kinds of complaints last year. Cop went down for it like 5 times. You like those odds?"
"You're just talking, man," he said.
"Oh, I'm not done. So, he gets off, because of course he's getting off,
and then you become public enemy numero uno for him and all his bunkmates in major crimes. Which means the next time they come looking for you, it's not going to be a possession rap. They'll trump some shit up. They'll tune you up in the process. Or, since you'll have really pissed off the good old boys by going to IA, they might just decide they saw you reach for something. Decide their lives were in imminent danger. He kept his hard stare, but my eyes were already following the tapping sound to his foot moving every which way. It was cold, but it wasn't that cold. In case you were wondering, that was the threat, I said. I highly doubted Scannell or his friends would ever try to kill this kid, or anyone for that matter. But it was plausible. To Antonio. Probably to a lot of people in the city. I didn't know if that said more about them or the department. Antonio jutted his chin out a bit, chewed his lip, kept up the don't-fuck-with-me glare, like it made a difference. "So you gonna tell me the other way this could work?" he asked. "Yeah. I'm gonna hand you $8,000. You're gonna pretend you never met me." "Eight? Interest for your pain and suffering. You think you can just buy me off like that?" I wanted to lecture him on the insanity of a drug dealer seeking the moral high ground, but then I remembered who I was working for and what I was doing. "Money's in my jacket pocket, Antonio. Just saying." His eyes wandered to where my hands were tucked. He stood there like that for a minute, keeping up the pretense that he needed time to think about this. But we both knew the way the world worked. I waited outside my car after it was over, making sure Antonio didn't double back and suffer a crisis of conscience. In the span of 5 minutes, I'd helped a dirty cop keep his job and likely financed a month of cocaine sales for Antonio. At that moment, a little conscience might not have been the worst thing. My conscience had her eyes trained on the newspaper I no longer worked for, using an elbow to keep the page trapped on a table while fishing at a soup bowl with her free hand. She was sitting in the back of a place called Heaven's Delight, an old brick building that didn't have a sign out front, so you knew it was good and it was cheap. They made one hell of an oxtail soup. She was muttering to herself, either reading the article in an incoherent whisper or providing a running commentary when I sat down across the table and banged my knee on the underside. A splash of soup leapt for freedom, clearing the rim of the bowl and turning a used car advertisement into a soggy puddle. "Asshole," Key said. "Sorry about the paper," I replied. "That's not why you're an asshole." "Well, there's a long list of reasons." "Don't start with the jokes," Key said, picking her saucer-wide eyes up from the paper and training them on me. The woman really needed to switch to tea. Her pupils were stuck halfway between the Lincoln Tunnel and the moon. "I checked with Antonio," she said. "Sounds like everything's handled." "Are you surprised?" I asked. "Also said you threatened him." "That's a pretty strict interpretation of the word," I replied. "I simply advised him of all the possible ramifications of his choices." "Sounds like a fancy way of saying threatened," she replied. "Hey, now, as the ordained rider of the two of us," she cocked her head to the side and cut me off before jabbing one of her unpainted, unmanaged fingernails at the newspaper. "You a rider? That's funny," she said. "I don't see your name in here anymore." "That's cold, Key." "So's what you did to poor Tonio," she said. I kept Tonio out of a lot more trouble than he'd normally get himself in and made him enough money to commit felonies to his heart's content. Poor isn't the right word. Now she smiled. I loved making her smile. It was the only thing that kept her from slapping the shit out of me. For as long as I'd been bouncing around the Brick City, Kiana Jackson had been my advisor, guide, friend, source, and when I needed it most, reality check. We'd met back when I was a reporter, or as I like to remember it, that point in time when I actually mattered. My first year on, the city saw a crazy surge in homicides. 10 days, 10 bodies. Chicago or Baltimore might do those numbers in a weekend,
but Newark could fit inside either of those places 12 times over. When a city's big but not huge, people tend to know the dead and dying as more than just names in the police blotter. They're cousins, neighbors. That guy who owned the bodega on Elizabeth Avenue, or that kid who couldn't keep his mouth shut in your son's math class. Like most of her city, Key knew at least one of the people who fell that week. Unlike most of her city, she decided to do something about it. On a particularly sweltering Wednesday that August, Key and a few others blocked traffic near Meeker Street. The week after that, the number grew to 30, then 50. A couple dozen more tacked on the next month. The department started sending details to monitor the protests, and the news cameras followed like they always do. It wasn't long before Key's bullhorn-aided screeds found their way to YouTube. Videos of her wild charcoal hair and way-too-large black T-shirts, usually made up at a local print shop that week and lined with the names of the city's most recent dead, racked up a healthy amount of views. Every now and again, she'd go way off script, suggest they arrest the mayor for negligence or something. Sounded crazy to me, but then again, I didn't live in the South Ward. If I had coin flip odds of making it home unharmed every night, I might have been out there with her. The city's homicide total dropped the next year, a little bit more the year after that. People stopped following Key into the streets, and my tribe got distracted by a state senator using campaign funds to cover up the fact that he was sleeping with someone who wasn't his wife. The protests died off, but people kept right on dying, just at a pace the city could sell as progress. Time heals exactly no wounds, but it helps you get used to the scars. Key still sent out text message blasts every week, announcing a new demonstration in a new intersection. Wednesday, 5 p.m., a bullhorn leading the loose collection of diehard activists who considered themselves the city's anti-violence coalition. They spoke, but nobody came who needed to listen. The city only rallied around people like Key when it was angry, and at that moment, Newark was hovering around its normal standard of shitty but tolerable. "So, you come all the way up here just so I could yell at you?" Key asked, eyes lost in the newsprint again. "Just curious if you had anything else for me right now." Most of my work came from the cops, mostly in the form of playing fixer for officers like Scannell who had jammed themselves up. Technically, I was a licensed PI, but I didn't do a whole lot of investigating. I was more like a problem-solver, negotiator, arbitrator, maybe a referee, whatever job title you wanted to affix to it. I cost less than an attorney, and the kind of cops that came knocking were more than happy to pay me to prevent an internal probe when I could. I had enough street contacts from my reporter days, people like Key, that I could usually broker a peace with whoever wanted to lodge a complaint before anything ever got on paper, as long as one side paid a commission. "You can't possibly be hurting for work, Russ," she said. "I mean, the way you keep bailing those major crimes boys out, you're going to put that union lawyer out of business." "Remind me why I like you again," I asked. "Because I might have something for you that doesn't make you want to throw up when it's over," she said. "I like you again." Key spun the page she'd been staring at, jabbed a finger at a two-column-wide gray rectangle filled with text that jumped from bold to italic to regular. Her talon was hovering over the paper's law and order briefs, a short item about a murder. I looked at the byline underneath, saw a name that put a phantom pain in my chest. The story was about someone named Kevin Mathis who was shot and killed in Woodland Cemetery shortly before 1 a.m. Wednesday. A police spokesman declined to comment on a motive, and a suspect had yet to be identified. "And?" I asked. "And a boy's dead," Key replied. "And a boy's dead on the west side, in Woodland, no less, at that hour. You know exactly what that is." Key made a futile attempt to narrow those cartoon eyes. I knew what I sounded like. I also knew I was probably right. "You just assume it's a gang thing," she asked. No, I just assume it's a drug thing, I replied. The bangers here are just dealers with dumbass code names, you know that.
Well, this boy's father seems to think otherwise, she said.
Oh, fuck me, Key. You let some good-hearted parent actually believe their own nonsense, I said.
You know how this ends. I used to get these phone calls once a week. Nobody wants to believe their kid died because of some shit they got themselves into.
Man says he can prove it, Key replied, leaning back in the chair and folding her arms. She hit me with the disappointed mom stare I'd come to loathe and fear in the 6 years we'd known one another.
Prove it? I asked.
He got a signed confession from the shooter? Dear Mr. I had to look down at the paper to remember the dead kid's name. Dear Mr. Mathis, I continued, I aced your son because I am actually human garbage. He was a really good kid, and he didn't deserve it.
I stood up from the table.
What are you going to tell me next, Key? The kid was going to turn his life around? I asked. Get a job at Home Depot? We've been at this way too long to trip over day one stuff.
She stood up, glare on high.
You just hit me with every assumption and stereotype there is, she said.
I went to say something back, but my tongue was out of ammo.
She was right. She knew it, and I knew better than to throw bad after worse when arguing with her.
Just talk to the man, in private. Investigate, she said.
That's your job, ain't it?
I don't really have time for this, Key, I replied.
Way I see it, you got all the time in the world.
I don't have any other jobs for you, she replied. Unless, of course, you want to do more of what you've been doing all day.
I stared at Key, but the harsh lines under her eyes gave way to Scannell's fat face and his coffee breath and his please-save-my-incompetent-and-borderline-corrupt-ass whine. I thought about him collecting a pension while I paid off my student loans just in time to start taking on a mortgage. I didn't want to do anything for the cops or this grieving dad who refused to believe his drug dealer son died for drug dealer son reasons. But the cops never stared at me like Key did.
Chapter 2. I've spent more time than I'd care to think about around the relatives of Newark homicide victims. And through each sad and infuriating conversation, one thing stayed the same. By the end of the interview, you might tell them more about their fallen son or daughter than they tell you. It's not that they lie. There was nothing nefarious about the wrong answers provided by each widow, brother, or mother that I'd spoken to in the past. They just didn't know. Maybe they didn't want to. I can't blame people for not going out of their way to find out why Johnny was face down in a stairwell at the Meeker Homes, why Denise might have been a familiar face at the Hotel Nile, one of the city's oldest and cheapest flophouses. From what Key told me about Austin Mathis, he seemed like a good enough man, a bus driver whose only brushes with the legal system came in the form of a few parking tickets. He worked nonstop, left to raise Kevin and his two sisters when Mom followed the needle to oblivion too many years before. He was the kind of client that still made this job worthwhile. Unfortunately, a quick glance at his son's background also made me think I was right when I told Key this was a waste of time. With one parent gone to work all hours and the other just flat-out gone, Kevin Mathis was conscripted to the street before he was old enough to know what that would mean. Dad barely around to help with your homework 1 year eventually leads to Dad not being around to drag your ass back inside when trouble comes the next. He had priors for drugs, but his known associates didn't set off any alarms in my head. No gangland players that I knew of, and he hadn't been tagged for anything violent. But the arrest locations were right on top of one another. The dots were too close on the map to mean anything else. He was dealing regularly in his own neighborhood. A kid who dealt in his neighborhood, shot dead late at night in that neighborhood in a graveyard stacked three deep with dealers. And Key wanted me to help prove it was something other than what it was. But she was right. It wasn't like I had anything better to do. At the least, I could convince her she was wrong, and my losing streak in our never-ending arguments. I stepped out of the Cutlass and into the park.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?